You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All righty, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm getting a little echo here. Let's work on that echo there. All right, that's a lot better. No, I'm still getting an echo. But in any case, I'd like to welcome to the table Bradley Williams. Bradley Williams is on the program right now, and we're going to be talking about assisted suicide and House bill out there in Montana 505 that ultimately would prevent, according to Bradley Williams, elder abuse, protect all Montanans, and he is the president of Montanans Against Assisted Suicide. So without further ado, let's get to him, and then we'll get to the Freedom Lines after that, my friends. I know it is anything goes on Friday, and let me give you the number. It's 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. So let's go to Bradley as we speak. Bradley, welcome to the program.
So thank you very much. I am president of Montanans Against Assisted Suicide. We're a nonprofit public benefit corporation. We're totally grassroots. We network with other folks, and we don't have any institutional funding. And we're really excited about the possibility of this issue getting to the governor's desk so he can speak to it.
Right. Now, Bradley, let me ask you a quick question here. You authored a blog or an op-ed that I saw. What was the driving force to actually implement this law? Because right now, from my understanding in Montana, assisted suicide is currently not legal anyway. Is that not correct?
That is correct. We actually have three laws, statutes that address it. One is deliberate homicide, one is mitigated, and one is soliciting and aiding a suicide. And they're all felonies. And but the promoters of legalized assisted suicide solicited and got a judicial decision that very narrowly said that if a physician assists in a suicide, he might have a defense based on consent.
Uh-huh.
So what this bill does is, and that decision has caused confusion within our community and throughout it, and for the last, since 2009. So what this law does, it provides definitions, clarifies the law, and ends the confusion.
All right. So what you're saying then, Bradley, is you're not necessarily saying that physicians, because I'm a physician here in Phoenix, Arizona, and I am a geriatric physician, and I also am a medical director for a hospice company, and I routinely deal with patients who are terminal, patients who are dying, and we routinely provide aid and comfort and palliative care to these individuals. So what's the distinction between kind of what we do, say, in helping a hospice patient die with dignity, without suffering, without pain, versus what you're saying here?
You know, what, and that's part of the, by our definitions in the bill. It's a short bill, it's one page. It clearly separates physician assisted suicide from our existing Montana laws and our Rights of the Terminally Ill Act that provides for doctors to provide palliative care, that'd be care without cure, comfort care, and also to withdraw treatment, withdraw equipment. And those are already existing. That's existing rights from 1992. And so what this law does is clearly separates the two. HB 505 does not in any way infringe on those standard practices in Montana.
Okay, so just to make this distinction clear for our listeners too. So, for instance, in Oregon actually has it legal to provide assisted suicide. And what that means is that that doctor and that patient can decide to basically end their life with an injection of a medicine that would literally just allow the patient to expire right there and then. Is that correct? That's what your view of assisted suicide is, where you're directly injecting something or giving a medication that expedites the process of dying.
And that's pretty close to the definition that the AMA has for physician-assisted suicide. And, you know, Oregon and Washington are the only two states that have passed referendums to have a process for that.
Right.
And what we do as an organization, we focus on the loopholes in those processes, and that's where we find our common ground across the spectrum with the citizens, that the loopholes in those laws clearly provide a new path for elder abuse. So that's where we found our common ground here
right.
in the state of Montana.
Okay, well, and I want to talk about that common ground, too, because based off the polls that I'm seeing, it seems like 73% of Montanans actually oppose this particular bill. But before I get to that, let me ask you this question, because I did read about a Dr. Eric Kress, who's a family physician at the Western Montana Clinic, and apparently, according to the article, he has written what is called aid in dying prescriptions for three patients since the Baxter versus Montana decision. So maybe you can help our listeners understand a little bit more, Bradley. What's that aid in dying prescriptions, quote unquote? What specifically is Dr. Kress referring to there?
Well, and that's the other thing that we're doing. The promoters of legalized assisted suicide changed the words, and they don't use assisted suicide. They use aid in dying.
Okay.
And that's where a lot of the confusion comes in because, as we just mentioned, palliative care and withdrawing of equipment, withdrawing the choices to withdraw treatment are all pretty standard across the country.
No, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. That's why it's a little confusing to me as a doctor, because I consider that aid in dying, you know,
right.
that's versus
right.
giving an injection, an actual lethal injection of something that literally precipitates the death. That's different than I would say aid in dying, which it sounds like you agree with that.
Yes, I do. And that's part of the confusion. And that's part of the reason for the law. HB 505 is to provide the definitions to make it clear what's what, and rather than bundling them together. So.
Sure. Now, Bradley, how would that be enforced, though? Because there is a very fine line there with respect to, let me give you an example. Say I have somebody who looks like they're terminal and they're having agonal respirations and it looks like the end is imminent here, and I give somebody, say, a dose of morphine to alleviate some of the load from the breathing and make it more comfortable. Is there a slippery slope where somebody could say, hey, if I give that morphine dose at that particular time, and that patient dies, you know, 5-10 minutes after the morphine was given, are you now going to say that that doctor is possibly going to be brought up on this law and in prison for 10 years? You follow what I'm saying? There's a kind of a...
Yeah, and that's the reason for the law is to separate that clearly. A quick reading of the law, within the law itself, it sets aside palliative care and the rights of the terminally ill as being beyond the scope of the definitions of our law. So it ends that, and that is not, you know, that's a comfort care treatment that has a double effect. It's been standard practice for years, and it
sure.
would not be considered physician-assisted suicide.
That would not be. Okay, well, listen, Bradley, I appreciate your time on the air. We're coming up on the end of the segment, so thank you for at least clarifying from your perspective what you see the definition of a physician-assisted suicide versus aid in dying, and at least clarify some of the questions that I had. So we do appreciate
sure.
your time on the air.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir. Okay, listen, it is Anything Goes Friday, my friends. We're going to open up the Freedom Lines right now. That's a great topic to start out with if you'd like. You know, physician-assisted suicide, do you agree with that? Or how about just, you know, palliative care and hospice? 1-866-987-THOM. Back with your calls on Anything Goes Friday in a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
From 1480 KPHX here in Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Alrighty, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for this, the last final day after a 7-day stint on the air. We appreciate the opportunity to be part of the Tom Hartman Program, but it is Anything Goes Friday, so a great way, Eric, to close out the festivities on this great, great program here.
I agree with you, Mike. I concur.
You concur. All right, so let me give you the number for the Freedom Lines, 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. Anything goes, but I do want to throw that topic out there. We just spoke to Bradley Williams, and it's kind of interesting. Let me tell you, that topic that we just discussed is a very difficult topic. It's a very emotional topic, and it's very much a gray zone because you do have two states, I believe Oregon and Washington, that have explicit laws on the books that state that a physician can actually assist in the suicide or the termination of a patient's life. That's a lot different than what I do with respect to the geriatric care that I provide and the hospice care that I provide, in the sense that we provide medications for patients who are terminally ill. The example I gave earlier, that somebody could literally look like they're going to be dying within, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour. You could tell oftentimes by agonal respirations, other signs and symptoms that you can ascertain as a physician, and you can give them medications that are clearly going to help comfort them. But those medications could be construed as, you know, also expediting the dying process because it decreases respiratory drive when you have something like a morphine. So that's why I asked Bradley Williams, is there a difference between what we do, providing palliative care and hospice care, versus what this bill specifies? And actually, he answered my questions, at least to my satisfaction, in the sense that what they're trying to do is separate out physician-assisted suicide from what's considered standard of care in the community. But again, with the gray zone there, now that a doctor can get 10 years in prison, that's pretty darn scary. So that bill, if it becomes law, needs to be very, very specific about what the standards of care are in the community, because if they're not, then you could see doctors literally going to prison for 10 years for simply trying to help alleviate pain and suffering and not necessarily expediting purposefully the dying process. So there's really two separate issues in that particular conversation that we just had. And I guess the key question would be whether or not somebody who believes in assisted suicide, where a physician can actually participate in a very direct way, that is something that a legislature or a referendum on a ballot would have to occur to codify that into law. Because if you don't have that into law, then you're going to have to assume that it's the standard of care that we just spoke about. So any case, that's my take on it. Very curious to hear what the listening audience would have to say. So let's go in order of occurrence here. First up is BB listening on WCPT in Oak Park, Illinois. So BB, welcome to the table.
How are you doing, Dr. Newcomb?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Thanks for calling into the program.
Yes, sir. I just want to first of all tell you I really thank you for doing this past week. I've really enjoyed your show, the way you've informed some of these ill-informed people and confronted them. And I also want to say that a week ago, last week with that Martin Luther King special that you had, it was one of the best shows I've ever heard, sir, and I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate you.
Well, I thank you, BB. I thank you, and I thank Martin Luther King Jr., too, for those incredible pieces of audio and inspirational words. I'll tell you, BB, that is something that when you listen to those words of that man, I still, even right now, I'm getting chills thinking about it. Very, very powerful, powerful words and wisdom and a great spirit. And boy, BB, if we could all just embrace the message of Martin Luther King Jr. and what he had to say, I think this world would be a lot better place.
I completely agree. And it was amazing how relevant some of the speeches he had would pertain to today.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. And look, when you speak truth to power, as far as I'm concerned, those are timeless, right? I mean, if you're speaking truth to power, that should be relevant in any era because it's the truth. And it's the way that, you know, we as human beings should embrace one another with love and compassion and caring and honesty. And, you know, we got to, like he said, keep hope alive, keep the dream alive, and keep moving forward. And hopefully this world will be a better place. And with people like you, BB, listening and sharing that common dream, I think it can happen.
Thank you, sir. Have a good weekend. Thank you.
All right, you too, sir. Okay, that's BB calling in from Oak Park, Illinois, opening up another Freedom Line here live on the Tom Hartman program at 1-866-987-8466. It's Anything Goes Friday, so get into the queue here, dial that number, and you will be on live national talk radio. So let's go next to Kevin. He's next up in the queue. He's listening on Free Speech TV from Erie, Pennsylvania. Kevin, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Dr. Mike, it's nice to speak to you. This is my first time calling, talking to you. I
spoken with Tom before and Mike Papantonio. This is my first time calling you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I hear the Pennsylvania accent, too, because I'm a Philly boy down in, from South Philly.
Yeah, I'm calling from Erie, up on the north coast.
Right, you're up a little further north.
Yeah, where they call, they say Pennsylvania in this region is more like a cross between New York and Alabama.
There you have it.
I just want to say, you know, congratulations for the work you've done on the show, and I think you've done a wonderful job. You have some really important things to say, and opinions I believe are valid opinions, and you're kind of like the antidote to the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys of the world out there. And so I appreciate that. I did want to say something about gun control, if you don't mind me getting off the track.
No, it's Anything Goes Friday, so whatever you want to speak about, Kevin, speak your mind.
Anything goes. You know, I suffer from heart disease and arthritis, and my doctor was telling me to get out and try to be more active. And I was calling around to different sports stores about camping equipment, and one of the guys there suggested, well, you know, there's things like target shooting and stuff like that, you know. I wouldn't mind owning a gun for target shooting. And I live in Erie. It's only the fourth largest city in Pennsylvania, but the crime rate here is astounding. There's a shooting every day.
Wow.
Somebody's shooting at somebody. Some kid gets shot last week, and then, you know, one of his friends shoots back at somebody else. A McDonald's three blocks away from me, and there was a shooting there.
Wow.
McDonald's of all places.
Hey, do me a favor, Kevin, because I know you've been holding on. I don't want to cut you short. Just hold on. We got to go to a quick break for our sponsors, but we'll be back, and I'll get you in the queue, okay?
Thank you.
All right, so just hold on. All right, 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Anything Goes Friday. Okay, welcome back to Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Let's go right back to Kevin from Erie, Pennsylvania, as he very artfully
still
described
here.
It, a cross between New York and Alabama. So welcome, Kevin.
Howdy. How y'all doing?
Howdy. So hey. You were talking about the gun and the shooting, and continue on from there.
There was a shooting in a local McDonald's here, three blocks away from where I live. You know, people go to McDonald's to eat food, you know, and some idiot walks in there with a gun and shoots somebody.
Right.
And a block away from there, there was a dance hall. They call it the Metropolitan. Somebody walked in there with a gun and shot four people, you know, wounded them all.
Wow.
But it was, you know, it's out of control here. So I personally have thought, you know, maybe it's time to consider getting a gun for personal protection, as well as, you know, the fun and activity of target shooting and things like that.
Sure.
I have nothing to hide about background checks. You know, I've been diagnosed with mild depression and anxiety, probably because of my heart disease and arthritis.
Sure.
But I have nothing to hide.
Right. And that wouldn't preclude
you. Bring a background check on. Bring it on, you know?
Right. And that wouldn't preclude you just because, like you said, even if you do have some anxiety or depression, that doesn't preclude you from actually owning a gun. You know, I mean, really what they're looking for is people who have mental illness that is out of control, is not treated, and obviously people with very aggressive, you know, homicidal or, suicidal or delusional tendencies. So that's a distinct
psychosis.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, distinctly different from what you're experiencing. So listen, all right, well, listen, Kevin, I appreciate that. Thank you for calling from Erie, Pennsylvania, and go Eagles.
Absolutely. Well, go Steelers, too.
Well, that's right. That's true. All right. I'll see you later.
Hey, it's been nice talking to you, Dr. Mike. Thank you.
Likewise. Bye-bye. All right. Yeah, you got to realize that there's also two teams in Pennsylvania. When you grow up in South Philly, Eric, the only team that you're aware of with football is the Philadelphia Eagles. So,
okay.
You don't like sports,
I know
though.
Somebody who actually played on the Eagles.
Who?
His name is Guy Roubé.
Guy Roubé.
Yeah, he played. It was years ago. He did the infamous, what was it, the pass he ran backwards to do the other goal.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm not very familiar with him. I can see why. He probably didn't have a long storied career.
No, I think it was pretty much over
after that point. Yes, absolutely. All right, let's get back to the Freedom Lines here. Let's see. Next in the queue is Virginia. listening on Free Speech TV from Seattle, Washington, where they actually have their own physician-assisted suicide in Washington. So interested to hear what Virginia has to say. Welcome, Virginia.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to congratulate you. You're doing a top-notch job, and maybe you ought to consider having your own little radio show, like on RT or something like that.
Well, thank you. Actually, we do a little local show here in Phoenix, Arizona, so but I do appreciate the compliment, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm an abortion that lived, and I've had multiple problems throughout life, and I'm really not going to commit suicide and give all those people that have treated me like I'm an inferior piece of you-know-what the
right.
satisfaction. But I wouldn't mind having a little physician-assisted at the end. No,
right.
no tubes and wires and all that.
Right.
My ideal death would be to go out on a mountaintop and sit down under a big tree and look at the valley below and just kind of drift off.
Well,
I know
I mean,
that there's a higher level of consciousness, and I'm going to go there.
Sure, sure. Now, in your state, though, Virginia, is it not true that you actually could do that, right? I mean, you can have a physician-assisted suicide in Washington.
I think that's true. I have never known anyone that tested it, but
yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, because really what the debate rages on is the following. Like you just said, you have sort of a vision of how you want to end your life. You recognize that, you mm-hmm. know, we're all mortal, that we're all going to die one day, and you want to die peacefully on your terms. And essentially, based off of the law in your state, it sounds as though you could probably set something like that up if you were terminally ill, versus in the other states that don't have physician-assisted suicide, you couldn't really end it on your own individual terms. And I think this is a debate that's going to rage, Virginia, for some time. And I suspect over time that more states will probably adopt what they're doing in your state with physician-assisted mm-hmm. suicide. But I don't see it becoming widespread in all 50 states. But I do think there is room for mm-hmm. other states to embrace it.
They can always come here.
Right?
Sit with me under the tree.
That's true. Well, listen, if that ever happens, you give me a call, and that'll be a good excuse for me to get out there to Washington and meet you.
Okay, thanks.
All righty, thank you.
Bye.
Okay, that's Virginia calling in from Washington, opening up another Freedom Line here on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday, 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. Eric, you were having an interesting little offline discussion with me before, because you were asking, with physician-assisted suicide, is the physician actually the one who, like, say, puts in the IV and then pushes the actual medication that's going to terminate life immediately, or is
right.
it the physician that sets it up
so
and then actually the patient can, you know, or some type of, because sometimes the patient can't do that. If the patient
right.
is.
I think that's how Kevorkian did it. He would
yeah.
set up an apparatus where
correct.
The person could just do it themselves.
Correct. And being that we don't have that here in Arizona, I'm not quite sure how the law specifies that in Washington or Oregon. What, maybe you can check that out for us in the interim and see if it's both ways, if the either one, the physician can do it directly, or two, the physician could set up the whole apparatus, like you said, but it's up to the patient to have to finally, you know, do what they need to do to carry that out. Okay, let's get back to the Freedom Lines here. Let's see, next up in the queue, looks like we got Mark Taylor Canfield. He is a reporter, and he wants to talk about something that's happening with respect to the Seattle police chief. So let's hear what he has to say. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Mike, it's good to talk to you again. I think I've actually talked to you down there at KPHX, too.
Yes, you did. I remember your name, so.
Yeah, we've got a story that I've been covering for Free Speech Radio News on the Pacifica Network, and I called in last week to tell you, the Tom's listeners, about the federal grand jury in Seattle where activists had been placed in solitary confinement. And last week I reported that Judge Richard Jones had released two of those activists, not only from solitary confinement, but from jail, saying that the grand jury holding them as material witnesses when they're claiming that they don't really have any information on what happened here on May Day last year when a federal appeals court had its windows broken. He said that, you know, that was ridiculous and it was a degradation to their physical and mental health to hold them in solitary confinement. So they've been released. And as of this week, the last person who is being held, Maddie Pfeiffer, who's actually been in jail since last August during this investigation of the uh-huh. May Day actions last year, he's been released as well. So at this
point, was he in solitary confinement that whole time?
Not the entire time, but most of the time, which means that he was in there for months and months and months, along with Catherine Olzinick and Maddie Pfeiffer. So Matthew Duran was actually released with Catherine this week. Maddie Pfeiffer was released, so there's no one left in jail. There's still, as far as I know, one subpoena left out there, and that person has not been called before the grand jury. But the real update for this week, Mike, is that our police chief, John Diaz, has resigned.
Wow, what happened?
It's all of this controversy amidst there was an 18-month Department of Justice investigation into the Seattle Police Department investigating excessive use of force.
Sure.
Which the DOJ pretty much concluded from their report it was a practice and policy of the Seattle police. You know, last year they got in trouble for pepper spraying an 85-year-old woman, Dorley Rainey, during the Occupy demonstrations. But the other issue was that there was a report, an independent report, that was just released. It was written by the former deputy assistant police chief of Los Angeles. And it was a very scathing criticism of the Seattle Police Department and their activities last May Day, saying that basically they failed to practice adequate crowd control, that they hadn't been trained in new crowd control techniques since the World Trade Organization demonstrations here in 1999, and that there were conflicting orders about how they were supposed to deal with the protesters. So this week, after about a year and a half, 2 years of demands by civil rights groups and activists in Seattle, the police chief has resigned.
So that's a big story.
Last year, 36 people were arrested inside the mayor's office during a sit-in demanding his resignation. So this is, you know, it's made some folks in Seattle who want police reforms a little bit happier because they feel like they need a new face behind the department. But as of this week, John Diaz is no longer our police chief. On Monday, he resigned.
All right. Well, look, Mark,
on that story.
That just goes to show you, though, that activism works, that if you're persistent and you believe in your cause and you keep putting that pressure on slowly but surely, you could achieve your end point, which in this case is, you know, you wanted the police chief to resign. So thank you very much for that update, Mark.
No problem. And I also wanted to let folks know it was 36 different civil rights and community groups that called for the U.S. Department of Justice investigation. So it has been a community effort for sure.
Absolutely. That's the way it's supposed to work. All right, listen, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, there you have it. Let me give you the number for the Freedom Lines right now. It's 1-866-987-THOM. Again, it's 1-866-987-8466. So what were you saying, Eric? You have a little update on that?
Well, yeah, you wanted me to look up the Arizona law on assisted suicide, correct?
Well, actually, the one in Oregon, but because we don't, you're not allowed assisted suicide.
Right, it's Arizona. It's considered manslaughter.
It's considered manslaughter. But what I'm curious about is in Washington or Oregon, does the physician actually
all 50 states right here?
Yeah, administer the injection or whatever you're going to utilize to, you know, expedite the dying process, or is it the patient's responsibility to finally do what they need to do? All right, so listen, we will be back, my friend. Stay with us. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program and Anything Goes Friday. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, Anything Goes Friday. We have a special guest on the line right now, but I do want to let the listeners know, if you were in the queue and you were holding, we had to reboot the call screening mechanism. So just give us a call back at 1-866-987-THOM, 1-866-987-8466, and get back in the queue. So we do have Dr. William Stixrud on. He is a clinical neuropsychologist. He's a member of the adjunct faculty at Children's National Medical Center, an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at George Washington School of Medicine, and also author of Plain Talk About Early Education and Development. So without further ado, let's welcome Dr. William Stixrud to the table. How are you, doctor?
I'm wonderful. Thanks.
It's great to have you here. Well, listen, before we get to speaking a little bit about this brain mapping and ADHD, you also are giving a keynote speech with respect to the Stroud Foundation. So do you mind just taking a quick opportunity to speak about the Stroud Foundation and what you'll be doing with respect to the keynote?
Sure. The Stroud Foundation is a foundation in the honor of Frank Stroud, who is a completely beloved pediatrician in Washington, D.C. for many, many years, and somebody who was a great champion for children who had learning disabilities or ADHD. And Frank really helped pioneer awareness and make was a great advocate for kids and ensuring that schools were doing the right things by children. And his foundation is set up to support schools that do the right thing with kids who have learning attention problems. And they're raising money tomorrow with a race, and I am going to be giving the introductory remarks.
Excellent, excellent. So it sounds like a phenomenal foundation, and I actually had the wonderful opportunity to meet Frank in person and his lovely wife, Candy Stroud, years ago. So two wonderful human beings, and thank you so much, Doctor, for the work that you do with that foundation. So in any case, let's talk about, you know, ADHD and this new initiative, if you will, by President Barack Obama, where they're looking to do this brain mapping now. I mean, we heard about, obviously, the genetic code and how that was something that the government acted as a catalyst to map our entire genetic code for the human species. But there's a new initiative on the horizons, and it has to do with mapping the brain. So, Doctor, tell our listening audience a little bit about that and what does that exactly mean? Because it's a little different than just sequencing genetic code.
So I don't know this. I'm not an expert on this new initiative, but I will say that the efforts to map the human brain and including the developing brain, to understand how the developing brain is organized and how it functions to produce thinking and behavior and feeling, has led to thus far has led to tremendously increased understanding of in my field of how to help children and teenagers and young adults who have ADHD or anxiety or depression or other kinds of developmental problems.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Tell us a little bit about ADHD, because that's something that we're seeing more and more in the news. Many new drugs coming out with respect to how to treat ADHD. Some people would posit that perhaps maybe it's an overdiagnosed disorder. Maybe others might say it's underdiagnosed. Give us sort of the update on where do we stand with ADHD? What is it? What are some of the effective treatments and outcomes?
Well, I think that it's something that certainly has been with us for a long, long time, and in its current iteration of ADHD since 1994, it refers to constellation of symptoms in some cases with impulsivity and hyperactivity, and in other cases where the predominant features are poor attention, poor organization, difficulty getting things done, spaciness, that kind of thing. And there's a recent study that concluded that about 11% of children in America now have been diagnosed with ADHD, and the incidence keeps rising. And the concern, of course, is there more of it, or are we just diagnosing more of it? Are we more sensitive to it? Are we over-diagnosing it? And it's a complicated issue because, on the one hand, anybody whose attention span or impulse control or organization ability is below the 20th percentile, which is 20% of the population, is going to probably have some trouble paying attention in school and completing their homework. So that there's going to be a lot of it.
Right.
On the other hand, there's many kids, and particularly boys, who are simply immature, who are diagnosed with ADHD because they can't sit still or because they're being asked to read and write and do homework long before they're developmentally ready to do it.
Right. No, I think I'm one of those kids, Doctor. When I was a child, we go back to the early days, and my parents and family would say, you know what, he just can't sit still. He's hyperactive. He's all over the place. And, you know, long story short is I ended up becoming a physician. I'm an internal medicine physician right now.
Right.
But I experienced something very similar with my son, because when he was in the school system, they said that he was, you know, distracted. He wasn't paying attention, et cetera. And they sort of made a preliminary diagnosis, or at least suggested it might be ADHD. But what ended up happening, doctors, we ended up just putting together some behavioral sort of cues for him that when he was sort of out of line or this or that, you know, like the light, the red, yellow, and green.
Right.
And it was amazing just putting that little bit of structure into him. He completely changed his behaviors just with that. So speak to that a little bit. Like, how do you know when to do behavioral changes like that, or then when is medication justified?
Okay. So the first thing is that that the evidence really supports using medication in kids who have ADHD. There's good evidence that it's effective, in at least in many cases. And the evidence also supports the kind of behavioral structuring kind of interventions that you're describing. And so for many kids, I'm certainly not crazy about situations where the first recommendation made is medication. And many kids respond to good behavioral structuring and paying attention to the kind of tasks that kids are being asked to do. Unfortunately, in my opinion, we're asking kids to do academic learning at younger and younger ages, even though after 80 years of research, there's still no evidence that homework contributes
to that. All right, listen, doctor, we got to run right now, but that's Dr. William Stixrud. We appreciate your time on the air. We'll be back at the top with more of the Tom Hartman Program and Anything Goes Friday.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to hour number two for Anything Goes Friday. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in. We got our callers all back in the queue right now. So if you want to participate, you simply pick up that phone, call 866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466, and we'll get you into the queue here. So I'm going to get to everybody here in one quick second, but Eric, you do have a quick update on the law with respect to physician-assisted suicide and what the physician, can or cannot do.
Well, the physician can administer or prescribe the medication, the lethal medication to you, but under no circumstances can they administer it to you. You have to do that on your own.
Well, no, they can prescribe it, but you have to.
But you have to take it yourself.
Yeah, you have to administer it on your own. Okay,
right.
So
doctors, otherwise that's considered euthanasia, and that's not legal.
And you can't do that. All right, so the physician sets it all up, tees it up, and then the patient, you know.
Sinks it.
Okay, gotcha. All right, well, that's definitely helpful. So let's go now next to Jane, and she is from Redding, California, and she also is a hospice nurse, so I love the work that people do for hospice. So let's go to Jane. Welcome.
Hi, Dr. Mike. Nice to talk to you. You're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I have been a hospice nurse for 15 years, and so I've had the opportunity to coach and mentor, you know, nurses, doctors, and, of course, family members of dying patients. And there's always that scary thought, what if this is the last dose of morphine or the last dose of a narcotic that this patient will be receiving? Does that mean that I gave them the last dose and I killed them?
Right.
And we go back to an ethical principle, it's called the principle of double effect, where the intent of our action is to promote relief of suffering, while a secondary result may be death. But
correct.
Our intentions are good intentions, and so if it results in death, it's not because we purposely did that, it's because it's a result of the condition or the disease that the person is dying from, and we're just simply trying to make them comfortable. But, you know, something else occurred to me with the last caller while I was waiting, and that is, you know, I've often thought, and I've also said this to other, you know, other nurses and doctors, we give our hospice patients a boatload of medications that are potentially can cause death.
Sure.
We're not watching them every minute. So what difference is that if I have someone with a 30 mils of morphine, liquid morphine, on their bedside table, they could drink that whole bottle, and that would be, in effect, they're determining their own death.
Right. No, and it would be, but the slippery slope there, though, is if there's no physician-assisted suicide and that bottle was there, and, you know, are they going to hold the hospice accountable? But let me ask you this, though. I mean, Jay, because I am a medical director for hospice here in Arizona, a company called Hospice of Arizona, phenomenal organization, and I'm curious about your perspective on this, too, because I'm not saying I necessarily disagree with physician-assisted suicide, but I have to say this from my experience of being a medical director and dealing with hospice and terminal ill patients, I've never really felt the need to actually have to expedite the death with a lethal dose of a medication. I've always felt that given the great team that we have at Hospice of Arizona, everything from spiritual coordinators to nurses to certified nursing assistants to physicians, nurse practitioners, we've always been able to come up with a plan, you know, with respect to the team and that patient's specific needs to palliate their suffering, alleviate the suffering, and never really had to go to the extreme where, you know, we have to expedite it and make it happen within the next 5 minutes. So I'm curious on your perspective of that being a hospice nurse.
Well, I totally agree with you. And I think the fact that hospice is a team, you know, we have so many different ways of coping with the suffering, whether it's existential or physical or whatever it is. I agree with you. I think that I can most of the time walk into a home and say, you know, I can almost promise you that you will not be suffering at the end of your life. And with people who are afraid of that, they might take that opportunity. But I think after meeting with the hospice team, they'll see that, we're going to be okay. We're going to be taken care of. And, it sounds like you have a great hospice. I think we have a wonderful hospice, too. And it's all about the team approach.
Right.
And,
yeah.
If someone is truly suffering and it's an existential, you know, suffering, and I know this is not something that is agreed upon with all hospice and palliative care people, but we do palliative sedation where we'll put them just under with the drug like Versed so that they really will not be conscious, but we continue to medicate for pain and other symptoms.
Sure. No, that's I share your perspective on many of these issues. So, all right, listen, Jane, thank you for taking time to call today from Redding, California. Thank you for all the work that you do as a hospice nurse.
Thank you back.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
All right, that's Jane. And, yeah, hospice is an incredible, incredible service. And a lot of people don't realize really what hospice is. I mean, if you were to survey the general population, most people are not even aware that they have a hospice benefit. I mean, Eric, I don't know if you know this, but most people who are, you know, of Medicare eligibility, Medicare has a separate benefit, which is a hospice benefit, separate from what you would have. Say your grandmother's on Medicare, right? Say she's 80 years old.
She was.
And she was. And she has a hip fracture, and she has to go into the hospital to get the hip repair. That's a separate benefit pool that you have. But say 5 years later, grandma developed, you know, cancer or end-stage Alzheimer's disease. She also has a benefit called a hospice benefit, which is separate and distinct from your straight Medicare benefit.
I did know that. You know how I know that?
How's that?
Because I listen to your commercials.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Because of Hospice of Arizona in Phoenix, Arizona. So my whole point is this, is that first and foremost, there a lot of people are not even aware that they have that benefit. They, you know, when they get that diagnosis from the doctor or the cancer specialist or whomever, whatever your diagnosis is, people don't realize. They just think, oh my God, I'm going to die. It's going to be painful. It's going to be suffering. Not realizing that they have a benefit that they could draw upon, which is the hospice benefit. And that hospice team, the way it works is you'll have a nurse come out, and the nurse will do an assessment. They'll take a history. They'll do a physical. They'll find out very specific things about your family dynamics, the support system that you have or don't have in your private home. And then that goes into an admissions process whereby I, as a medical director for hospice, I sit on what's called an IDT team. It's an interdisciplinary team comprised of nurses, certified nurse assistants who actually go to the home and help, you know, move the patient if they need to be help moving, if they help the patient in toileting, if they need help with that, and bathing and eating, all types of different activities of daily living. Then we have obviously the physician, me leading the team meeting, so we could talk about specific medications, specific drugs, drug-drug interactions, things that are going to make the patient feel better, have less suffering. And it's a great, great benefit. And just the bottom line is a lot of people in America are unaware that they have this hospice benefit available to them. And that's been my experience in working with hospice, is that I can't really recall any time in, you know, over a decade of work whereby I felt the need, or the patient that was under hospice felt the need, to expedite their death within 5 minutes. On the contrary, by having that multidisciplinary team approach, we are often able to alleviate any of the pain, any of the suffering, and not only help that patient die with dignity and kindness and respect and compassion, but also take that as an opportunity during the time under the hospice services to celebrate that patient's life, to memorialize them, to really go back in time and realize what a gift it was to be here, and how blessed somebody really is, how blessed we all are, quite frankly, because we all are gold medal winners and we all are miracles of existence. And so that's kind of the approach that we take with hospice. And you know, maybe physician-assisted suicide is an option in at least certain other states, but I just, in my medical practice thus far, have never seen the need yet to conduct such, you know, activities. Any case, 1-866-987-8466. It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls in a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get to the Freedom Lines. Anything Goes Friday. First up in the queue, I believe, let's see, Eric, I want to be fair about here, whoever's been waiting the longest, let's go here to Susan online, and she's in Bellingham, Washington. Welcome, Susan.
Well, thank you. I think you're doing a great job for Tom.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit more in detail about this law we have in Washington. First of all, one has to be within 6 months of death. You know, the same way hospice looks at that. They can
right.
be renewed, but then they have to talk to either two doctors or a doctor and a psychologist. And if that all goes well, they are given a prescription. And I know that it has barbiturates in it. I'm not clear of all the pieces in it. But the
right.
prescription is filled at the drugstore. And this medicine is very, very distasteful. And one drinks it. And that's why I think it's possible to do without a doctor having to give an inoculation. And where it's been most helpful is we in Washington, and I think in every other state, there are a lot of suicides where people might shoot themselves or hang themselves. I mean, really,
right.
really ugly things. And our statistics show so far that more people who have that particular medication are not using it. They're more able to go to the end of their life. We have
right.
a very small hospice house here. It isn't so big, so there's lots of home treatment
right.
for the hospice part. But it's been amazing how many people have been able to just sort of have that tucked away someplace and feel that they have some control,
right.
have not used it.
Like an insurance policy. No, I understand that. So, see, that's why I'm very curious, Susan. You bring an interesting perspective to this, because in all of my medical career, like I said, I've never really run into a situation where a patient had something like that, a cocktail that would cause them to die immediately. I've never had a patient really want to do that. And I think the fact of the matter is that when we can bring in our fellow brothers and sisters and family members and friends and the hospice team and all work together to make sure that that patient has all the appropriate resources that they need and all the appropriate medications to die a dignified, comfortable death. Oftentimes, like you said, they go to the very end of their life without ever having to utilize that particular cocktail. So it's kind of an interesting discussion. So thanks a lot for calling in, Susan.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Now. Okay, so that's kind of an interesting perspective on that. Okay, opening up another Freedom Line at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Let's see. Next up in the queue will be Robin, listening on Free Speech TV, calling from Oklahoma, Poteau. Is that how you say it, Robin? Is it Poteau?
Poteau.
Poteau. Okay, Poteau, Oklahoma.
P-O-T-E-A-U.
Poteau. Okay.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. What I wanted to know was, like, if they give you, they tell you that you have only so much long to live, and would I have the right to refuse treatments that would prolong life, but there'd be, like, consequences, you know, not just the cancer treatments, but other treatments.
Yeah, I mean, as a patient, Robin, you have absolute control over your own final destiny for the most part, because no treatment could ever be forced upon you. You have the right to refuse any type of treatment that is offered up to you. So you have complete autonomy, complete control, and no doctor, no government, no agency could force you to undergo procedures or take medications that you want to take against your will.
Does the state assisted medical things, like the Medicaid, does it cover hospice? And I'm going to get a living will, fill it out. Can I put on a DNR because I have bad bones? And if they did something on me, they'd crack them.
Yeah, you could actually, well, two questions. One, state Medicaid, which is, so people understand what Medicaid is. I know most people do, but Medicaid is an insurance policy for people who are less well off financially. So the state will provide your medical care via the state insurance policy. So some states do have hospice as a covered benefit, but some states don't. So it's really going to depend on which state you're in. Now, if you're a Medicare recipient, then Medicare is the hospice is a guaranteed benefit, I believe, for all Medicare patients. But it's state to state. It's different with respect to Medicaid. But then you get into what you're talking about, your own living will. So under the living will and other different types of legal documents, you could say specifically the types of treatment you want or don't want. So, for instance, you mentioned DNR, right? And just so people understand what that means, that just means do not resuscitate. So, in other words, if your heart were to stop beating all of a sudden or your lungs were to stop functioning, people can invoke what's called a DNR or a do not resuscitate. And there's actually two components to that, really, because there's a CPR, right, or, you know, resuscitation where people could actually, you know, press on your chest. And also there's stuff where you can put a tube down your throat and also put you on a respirator. So you can decide what type of DNR you want to be. It could be a DNR that says, I don't want chest compressions, or it could be a DNR that says, I want chest compressions, but I don't want to have a tube put on into my lungs so that I have to be on an artificial respirator. So you could custom tailor your specific desires in those particular documents, Robin. So listen, I got to run, but I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot for calling in. Okay, bye-bye now. All right, we're going to be back with more of the Tom Hartman program. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, this is Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the program, the Tom Hartman Program. Let's get to Peggy listening on Free Speech, and she's calling from Issaquah, Washington, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, Peggy. It's Issaquah.
It's Issaquah, right? Okay.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, doing this program for the last 2 weeks, getting to see all the different city names across the country.
Tongue twisters.
Some of them are tongue twisters.
Yeah, especially out here in the West.
Yeah, absolutely. So what's on your mind today, Peggy?
Well, one thing, listening to your show, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There's a lot of confusion about the Death with Dignity law in Washington.
Yes.
2 years ago, my father invoked his right to death with dignity. the drugs are prescribed. You don't have to. If the 6 months within death, that's not true, because every case is different. And you know, his doctor, the way it should go down and does go down are two different things. But they're hooked up to an IV. The doctor prescribes the medication. He's monitored by respiratory technician and nursing staff, and the drugs are administered through an IV.
Okay, so that one, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So that, now who administers that?
The nursing staff administers it. The biggest problem here in Washington is the law kind of doesn't go far enough. Or like his doctor, a week before he did this, his doctor specialist, he had been on life support for 3 weeks. He came off. He only had 10% lung function. The specialist told us when we met with him that he had reached the point to where, if he chose to do Death with Dignity, that, you know, he was at that point that he could do that. Uh-huh. That doctor was out of town, and his GP was in charge of his case. And he personally does not agree with Death with Dignity, and he tried to fight it the entire day.
The doctor did?
He could.
The doctor tried to fight it.
Tried to fight it.
Right.
But with the advocacy of the nursing staff and the hospital social worker, we were able to carry out my dad's wishes and allow him to go peacefully. And it is, you know, it is very dignified, and it's you know, we all got to spend the day with him privately and together. You know, kids from out of town got to call and talk to him and say goodbye. And, you know, we got to spend the whole day with him, and we got to say goodbye. And it really was a wonderful, wonderful experience. But, you know, like, this doctor should have stepped down. If you fire him, the hospital is not allowed to refer you to another doctor. You would have to go scramble to find a doctor to help you at that point.
So let me ask you this then. So your dad was in the hospital at the time, right? They had just removed him from the respirator, correct?
He had, 3 weeks before, he was more and more often going into respiratory duress. When he went into life support or into respiratory arrest 3 weeks earlier, he was at 30% lung function.
Okay.
He was on life support for 3 weeks. And, you know, when you're on a ventilator, it damages your throat and everything.
Sure.
They took him off. Miraculously, he started coming back. He was able to breathe on his own a little bit. He was on a CPAP or a BiPAP machine most of the time.
Okay.
But he had moments where he could be off of that. But he also was on steroids to the point that he was hallucinating. And, yeah, I mean, he was out of his mind crazy with on these steroids.
Right.
And he woke up one morning. They had put him in a nursing home. He also had MRSA in his lungs.
Right.
They had him in isolation. He was on the BiPAP. He was out of his mind on steroids. He shouldn't have been there. They allowed him to sign papers at this nursing home.
Right.
And then I managed to get him transferred back to the hospital on Friday. Saturday morning, he had been so long without any treatment that the steroids had worn off.
Right.
And he woke up and he just said, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore.
So let me ask you this then. So he's in the hospital now. He has an attending physician obviously caring for him, because every patient admitted to a hospital has to have an attending physician. So at that point, did he say, I want to invoke my the Death with Dignity law? And at that point, the hospital was able to place an IV into him and then intervene?
That's the optimal. Like I say, this doctor tried to fight it as much as he could. The procedure is an IV is put in and the drugs are administered during an IV. This doctor,
right, but not by your father. Your father doesn't push the syringe.
No.
Like the actual staff at the hospital does it. Okay, I got you.
The hospital does it. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
And you know, it really, as it should be, is it's a very peaceful way to go, because people do get to that point where
sure.
they they are unable to continue on.
No, and I agree. Well, listen, let me get to the other callers, but I really do appreciate, Peggy, you taking time out to share that with a national audience. I know it's very difficult. It's your father, and to explain to the national audience about his dying moments, I think really lends a good perspective to what really is happening out there. So I really appreciate that, Peggy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right.
So it's always tough to talk about that, you know, and I think Peggy did an admirable job, because sometimes, you know, people can't do that when you talk about your loved ones or your parents and spending those very last moments with them. It can be very, very emotional. So I really, truly appreciate Peggy for doing that. Okay, that opens up another Freedom Line at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466. Let's go back to more of the Freedom Lines. Next up is Bruce from Atlanta, Georgia, and he's listening on Free Speech TV. Bruce, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hello, Dr. Hartman. Thank you very much for taking my call. Did I call you Dr. Hartman?
Yeah, that's okay.
If it was his name.
I've been called a lot worse, so don't worry about it. That's fine.
Okay, cool. All right, let me get to my point and see if I can make this as quickly and as concisely understandable as possible.
Sure.
I was reference is to guns and the this mandatory gun ordinance that certain places like, say, Nelson, Georgia here is considering. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah, they're talking about actually making it mandatory to own a gun, right? To actually have a gun in your household?
Yes,
it's required by a local law. And,
wow.
From what I understand, first of all, I had never even heard of Nelson, Georgia until recently. I'm from Georgia. I'm from Atlanta.
Right.
And until recently on the local news, they had a small piece on it. And from what I understand, it is a small town with like one or two on-duty cops. And they would like to pass some sort of ordinance that is similar to the one that's been on the books since 1982 in Kennesaw, Georgia, to allow the local community to be able to protect themselves in case they have to, because there's so few cops on duty at any given time. And I have no problem with that. But my point is, how is this ordinance in some little dust speck of a town that I've never heard of going to affect my day-to-day or anyone's day-to-day, say for here in Atlanta or in D.C. or where are you out in Arizona?
Well, I think what it gets down to, really,
why should I be concerned?
I think what you should be concerned about is because it's a constitutional issue with respect to someone's individual liberties and freedom. So I don't think that even if it's a local ordinance, if somebody wanted to bring up a lawsuit against that, I think they would have a very strong argument that indeed a government or a city council or any type of state agency cannot force you to actually own a gun. You have a right to own a gun, but there's nothing in the Constitution that says, you know, that the ownership of a gun is something that every American citizen must undertake. So I think that's on a constitutional ground. You can't make somebody buy a gun. So I think that's where it could affect you, even if you're not living there, because if they try to start passing this legislation, hey, it's a small little town. It sounds like the town from Deliverance or something. From
it must be out of control.
It sounds like that movie Deliverance, and you know,
like Mad Max.
Right? They need to own a gun. But yeah, so I think that's where you're talking about discrimination and infringement on somebody's liberties and rights, and that's where I think it becomes a constitutional issue, and that's why it could affect you if it starts to become more widespread. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But listen, Bruce, appreciate the call. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Dr. Newcomb, you have a good day.
All right, thank you.
That must be one scary town, man. If you got to carry weapons, you know, if everybody head of every household has to
pack and heat. The pack and heat resolution.
My guess, it's a sleepy little town with very, very low crime rate, and yeah, he wants to arm everybody.
Right, and it probably is the case. You know, there's probably like five people who live there, and
there's no crime.
There's no crime at all.
Everyone knows everyone.
Well, maybe they're looking for their 15 minutes of fame, Eric, just trying to get on the national spotlight.
Yeah, just spitting in the face of all these poor people who've had relatives killed by guns.
Right. Instead of mandating that every child has health insurance, they want to mandate that everybody has a gun,
yeah,
or that every kid has access to education, or that the mindset of the conservative is just, to me, sometimes perplexing. I mean, I'd love to just, you know, when they get to that brain mapping that we talked about earlier, I would love to see the brain map of a conservative. I mean, who knows? Maybe it's just a one-way road. You know, it's just
in their genes. Maybe it's genetic.
It might be, but that's what I'm saying. It might just be two neurons that we actually end up.
Is it nurture or nature, Mike?
Yes, it's nature and nurture. It's actually both. But fascinating thing, that brain mapping. We were trying to get some guests on for that during this the last 2 weeks, but have been unsuccessful. But we'll, you know, I'm sure Tom will talk about it on the program in the future, because it's something that the Obamacare administration is – not the Obamacare administration, but the Obama administration is pushing this as a strategic initiative for America, you know, like going to the moon or going to Mars. You know, we're going to go deep inside the brain and map what the brain circuitry looks like. Fascinating stuff. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, and it's Anything Goes Friday. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday. We're going to get to your calls on the Freedom Lines in a bit, but we do have our special guest, as we always do during this segment, from Talk Radio News, none other than Victoria Jones. So let's get to Victoria and see what's happening in the world at large. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
It's great to hear from you again.
Thank you. Well, there's plenty going on. White House spokesman Jay Carney seeking to tamp down some concerns over North Korea's nuclear capabilities today at the briefing that I attended, flat out saying that the country's not yet capable of launching a missile. So we might find out about that in the next few days. He said, obviously, the North Koreans have tested nuclear weapons and they have developed some missile technology. What they have not demonstrated is a capability to attach a weapon to a nuclear weapon and fire it. It is our assessment that North Korea has not demonstrated the capability to deploy a nuclear-armed missile. Now, the reason he was saying this is because a report by the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency that was disclosed, actually it was let out of a bag like a cat by a Republican member of Congress in a congressional hearing yesterday, claimed with moderate confidence North Korea has the ability to launch a nuclear attack.
Interesting. Now, Victoria, if they were to launch such an attack, are they saying it'll be at South Korea? What's the speculation of where they would strike if they were to do such a foolish thing?
Well, it's hard to tell with North Korea what they're going to do because they're kind of weird. But one news report within the last 24 hours from North Korea said that they might be going after Japan.
Oh, wow.
So, and that, of course, is following a number of reports that people have been talking about, including The Daily Show, where they were targeting the United States, New York, Washington, D.C., and Austin. But Japan, they have mentioned quite seriously. But then, of course, we are in quite a serious time because they're very interested in doing missile tests round about anniversaries. In fact, their most recent test, for which they got slapped with very severe sanctions, was just before the State of the Union. Again, a big event for them. And Kim Il-sung, the founder of their nation, has the anniversary of his birth is this Monday, the 15th. And he is the grandfather of Kim Jong-il, the young leader of the country.
Right,
Kim
Jong-un,
Kim Jong-un, sorry, Kim Jong-un.
Yes. Great. So what else we got going on?
What we also have going on is some Guantanamo Bay news, two pieces of news, actually, all of it rather shocking. The first piece of news is that lawyers representing the hunger-striking detainees at Guantanamo Bay are warning that they're worried that some of the protesters could soon die, and fresh details are coming out about the conditions at the camp from lawyers visiting clients and letters being written by inmates. And also the numbers of inmates involved in this hunger strike are really being disputed. Also the origins of the hunger strike are being disputed. The lawyers representing the hunger strikers say that some of them have lost 40 pounds. Some of the hunger strikers are saying they've lost 30, 40 pounds. One hunger striker writing a letter saying that he saw 2 days ago a prisoner hung himself in his cell. They took him to hospital. I have not heard any news about him since. Spokesman for the military flat out denies that there have been any suicide attempts. Meantime, all reporters have been denied access to Guantanamo Bay. So we really don't know what is going on there. But it's very disturbing. And the defense attorneys claim that the vast majority of the inmates at Guantanamo are protesting the fact that they're still there, though nearly all of them have been cleared for release.
Right.
But they're not being let go. But the military is saying that maybe a third of them are on hunger strike.
Wow.
Another Guantanamo story is astonishing, following on a number of other shocking stories about monitoring of proceedings and defense communications, when it came about yesterday that hundreds of thousands of defense emails were turned over to the prosecution.
Wow. Unbelievable. I mean, was there any official statement from the administration? I know you said you were at the press conference with Carney earlier. Did this come up?
No, not in my hearing. I actually had to leave early, but it didn't come up in my hearing. They were more focused on North Korea today, and it hadn't come up at the time that I left, but it didn't come up. But it was quite they only found out because some IT people were doing a search, and they kept coming across these defense emails, and they thought it must be a mistake. And then eventually they found all these hundreds of thousands of defense emails. Other things have happened, such as entire files, computer files, just disappeared. Months of work just gone. Also in February, a military lawyer acknowledged that microphones were hidden inside devices that looked like smoke detectors in rooms used for meetings between defense counsel and their clients. Those have now been disabled.
Wow. Well, Victoria, as always, thank you for all of this information. We really enjoy hearing it from you, and I in particular like speaking with you. So thanks for all you do with Talk Radio News.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. That's Victoria Jones with Talk Radio News, and we're going to be getting back to the Freedom Lines here in a second. Let me just give you the numbers. It is 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. We got a full board of callers. The Freedom Express is rumbling along right now. We got one more full hour left, so we're going to get to everybody. As I said, Eric, people calling from all across the country. Maryland, it got New York, you got West Virginia, Colorado, Iowa, Wisconsin, Montana. I mean, this is truly a representation
of
the voices of the people of America. So definitely look forward to having these conversations. Some people want to talk about ADHD. Others want to talk about nurses shouldn't wear scrubs outside of the hospital. Eric, we got, people want to talk about having the option to choose death and gun control and this and that. This is what happens on Anything Goes Friday. Anything goes. Correct?
That's what it's all about.
That's what it's all about. Democracy in action. All right, stay with us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to hour number three, the final hour before the week's end, and it is Anything Goes Friday, so we're going to get right to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-8466. First up in the queue, let's go to, let me see here, let's go to Mary. She's in Queens, New York, listening on WWRL. Mary, welcome to the table.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Mike. You know, I have a major gripe about doctors and nurses and aides wearing their scrubs back and forth to work, riding public transportation, going to restaurants, shopping, and then back home again. I think that they would cut down on a lot of infections rather than carrying germs back and forth all the time.
Okay, well, Well, I'm wearing scrubs right now, but I haven't seen any patients today, so actually I'm just wearing them for comfort. Uh-huh. But the bottom line is, yeah, you know what? You make a good argument there. I mean, I don't think if you're wearing scrubs that you were in a hospital and you were doing surgery. Look, there's different things. I mean, if you're a surgeon and you're wearing scrubs in the operating room and, you know, there's blood being splattered around there, body fluids being splattered around there, I don't think that's prudent to go walk out of that emergency, out of the surgical suite and then go into, you know, the public at large. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. But some people wear scrubs just for convenience sake too. Like they might work in a hospital and wear scrubs and they're not having any direct patient contact. It might just be an office or a desk job or, you know, watching a monitor or something along those lines. But I agree, if you're actually having body fluids that have contact with the scrubs, then I think it would be prudent to remove those scrubs before you go into the public domain.
Yeah, I heard in other countries that they have to change their clothes when they get to a hospital. I spent a lot of time in hospitals with loved ones, you know, hours and hours at a time, and I've seen them go from room to room, out to lunch, sit out on park benches. And I've even seen people sitting, waiting on a curbstone for their ride to pick them up.
Yeah. I mean, basically what you're – the more global picture that you're painting here, Mary, has to do with nosocomial infections. And what that is, it's those are infections that are transmitted within the – institution itself, so whether it be a hospital or a nursing home like you were talking about, and that is a big issue because a lot of patients, you think you go into the hospital and you think that the hospital is the safest place in the world. Well, on the contrary, all of those bugs, all of those organisms, all of those bacteria, you know, they're there trying to survive just like everybody else, and the more that those bacteria are exposed to different types of antibiotics, they figure out ways to live and survive, those bugs become resistant, and then ultimately it's very difficult to treat these infections that are acquired in the hospital type setting. So that's what I think you're ultimately alluding to, that if you have all of these infectious organisms that are more resistant to treatments with antibiotics and whatnot, and now you're taking those potential, you know, organisms on your clothing or whatnot and then transferring them to another venue, that can become a public health crisis. So I hear what you're saying and I appreciate it, and I thank you for calling, Mary.
And thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that's Mary from WWRL in New York City, opening up another Freedom Line here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. 1-866-987-THOM is the number. Let's go next to Carol, who's listening in Dillon, Montana on Free Speech TV. Carol, thank you for your patience and holding.
Oh, that's okay. Thank you for being there. I got a question to ask you. How, and it's a serious question, and I think it deserves a lot of attention. How do you overthrow a government?
Well, there's multiple ways to overthrow a government. I mean, you could do it forcefully, you know, through an act of aggression, which is not uncommon in many of these third world countries where you see coups of dictatorships happening routinely. Or you could overthrow a government, which the way that I think our founding fathers thought about it, which is a democratic way of overthrowing a government. You go out there and you vote out the people whom you don't feel represent you and your community's interest and take over the government that way. So there's a forceful way to do it, or there's a democratic way to do it.
Well, I'm beginning to believe that somebody's been reading a book and then translating it to the Conservative Party, because there's a lot of things that you start by dividing a country, and then you get people feeling sorry for themselves about their taxes, and then you've crashed the economy, so they really have something to feel sorry about. And then you pull all the safety nets out from under them.
Right. Yeah, well, it sounds like that would be a great way to agitate them, right, and get them really upset about things. But no, I hear what you're saying. Look, I mean, if you go back to the colonial days, right, back in the day where you had King George III over there in England dictating to the colonists, you know, what they can or cannot do, taxation without representation. Look, those colonists tried to go through peaceful measures, right? They tried to say, look, we don't agree with this. We want representation in our government. If you're going to tax us, we want our local people to sit on a board or sit on a council and have a vote and do this the democratic way through, you know, discussion and discourse and compromise. But King George didn't want that to happen, right? And instead, what he did was he brought in the redcoats and he brought in his military, and then And not only were people not having true democratic representation, they were now being forced to do things under the point of a gun. And I think at that point, that's when we as a nation, an early nation, said, hey, we're not going to stand for that. And at that point, we had to rise to arms. At that point, you know, colonists had to get their muskets and their guns and, you know, burn spoons and forks and this and that and melt them so that they get little pellets for bullets. And, you know, we took up arms. Now, obviously, that I don't think that's the first course, and I don't think that's the best way to go about it. I am definitely a proponent of democracy and voting and freedom. But at some point, there are such things as evil governments and dictatorship that, you know, will not be overthrown unless actual force is undertaken. So, you know, there's two ways to look at it. But listen, Carol, I appreciate it. I want to get to the other callers. Thanks for calling in today. Okay. All right. There you have it. That's Carol opening up another Freedom Line here on the Tom Hartman program, my friends. Let's go next. Let's see who's in the queue in order of priority. Let's go to Ollie listening on KBCS in Seattle, Washington. Ollie, welcome to the table.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Newcomb. I have great appreciation for you.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to go back to when you spoke with the doctor about the ADHD.
Yes.
And he was talking about how the numbers have been rising since 1994 and how they have drugs for it, new drugs coming out. And, well, what I wonder is what do they expect when you feed our kids with GMOs, processed foods, hundreds of pounds of sugar, and they put fluoride, a neurotoxin, in their water, and then expect them to go to school and sit still and concentrate.
Well, Ollie, you bring up an excellent point, and I have to confess to you, in the medical world, particularly in medical schools, nutrition and diet and what you actually put into this great machine we call the human body is really not emphasized a whole lot. And I agree with you. I think there's a whole new study waiting to happen, you know, a whole new wing, if you will, of a discipline of medicine that has to look more concretely and objectively at nutrition. Because, look, it's just like a computer. What do they say with a computer? Garbage in, garbage out, right? Well, if you're putting garbage into your body, like you said, with GMOs and processed food and sugars and whatnot, you know, then those kids equilibrium is going to be affected. You know, the way that they feel, their nervous system is going to be affected, their mind's going to be affected, and the way that they act ultimately is going to be affected. So you're bringing up an excellent point, and the point is, what role does nutrition play, not only in ADHD for that matter, but in general health and equilibrium overall, right? I mean, that's basically what you're saying.
Well, yes, and I'd like to add, you know, what my simple rule for health is, if it isn't natural, don't eat, drink, or inject it, because our bodies weren't designed to process chemicals and things that weren't natural.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you could go natural, that's always a preferable route. But don't forget, not all natural things are good either, too. I mean, snake venom's natural, but I wouldn't encourage you to take that either. So you got to be careful in what you select. All right, listen, I appreciate it, Ollie. Thanks for calling in. We got to run. Okay. So listen, when we get back with the Freedom Lines open, it's Anything Goes Friday, 1-866-987-8466.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Asking from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back. Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. It's Fast and Furious. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today will be my last day sitting for Tom for at least this period of time that we've had over the last 2 weeks. So if you want to get some of your final thoughts in, feel happy and free to call us at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Let's go next to August on the line from Cosmills, West Virginia, listening on Free Speech TV. August, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mike Newcomb. You're doing a fine job filling in for Tom, I think.
Thank you.
I'm having a hard time speaking. By the way, I'm a former Philadelphia resident.
Oh, awesome.
Cornwall's Heights. Huh? It was about two blocks away from the Red Lion Inn in when it was still there, and George Washington actually did sleep there.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Anyway, so tell us about your personal story here.
Well, About 3 months ago, I just woke up with a sore on my tongue and didn't go away. Finally, I went to my local rural doctor here, and they sent me for a CT scan, and they came back as probable head and neck carcinoma.
Right.
And, I'm 48 years old, and I've worked full-time up until January about 2011. And before I was laid off for the last 5 years, I worked in the oil field as a tree cutter. And this possible neck carcinoma was indicated, like I said, by a CT scan, which has already cost about $1,200. I have no insurance whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And I just got a few thousand dollars in the bank. And I've got no Medicaid, nothing. And, you know, I've never wanted or I needed assistance, you know, before. Now that the doctors here realize that I don't have Medicaid or any kind of insurance, I'm being shunted to the rear. They took my biopsy last week, and I can't even find out the result until late this month. You know, and meanwhile, my local rural doctor, whom I've got more respect for than these specialists that I've seen up in Carlsbad, you know, he prescribed pain medication about 3 weeks ago, which I'm going to run out of by Sunday. But here in West Virginia, if you use up your pain medication before the 30-day supply that's recommended, then you're under suspicion of being a user or a pusher. And
sure.
They can have a deputy show up at your door to do a pill count. You know,
wow.
I'm going through enough right now without having the cops show up here to see if I'm properly taking my medicine.
Right. Let me ask you this, August, because it sounds like obviously you have a very serious illness. Anytime you get head and neck cancer, that's a very, very serious type of cancer and oftentimes more aggressive than some other types of cancer. So you do need to get your treatment and you need to get it quickly. So let me ask you this. In West Virginia, I'm not sure how it works with Medicaid, but, you know, if you're laid off right now and you don't have a lot of, say, personal savings, it sounds like you would be eligible to get onto the state Medicaid rolls there. Have you investigated that yet?
Yes, I did that about maybe 3 weeks ago, and the normal time for you to get approved or disapproved is at least 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, but you have extenuating circumstances. So what I'm saying is that you might need to talk to the people at the Medicaid office and let them know that indeed you have been diagnosed with a biopsy-proven head and neck cancer, and that
I still haven't gotten the results of the biopsy. This was just a CT scan that came back as a suspicion. And
right.
You know, your former caller, Ollie, there, she also makes a damn good point because, you know, I've lived here now in West Virginia for 21 years, and I'm on well water, and there's about 15 gas wells within a mile of me. And you talk about your unknown chemicals in frac water, and
sure.
That's maybe leaching into my drink water. And, you know, if you're a smoker or a former smoker, then bang. That's
right.
What the doctors say. That's the cause of your cancer.
But well, it remains to be seen. But the point is this, is that if you have suspicious lesions, they've been biopsied, if they took it a few weeks ago, then you should surely have those results back. It doesn't take 2 to 3 weeks to get a biopsy back from a tongue. So you need to follow up on that very aggressively, find out exactly what the cell type is, if it is a cancer, and then take the copy of that actual biopsy with you to the state Medicaid office and say, look, I have a biopsy-proven cancer. I've seen specialists, and I need to get care, and I can't wait 3 to 6 months to get this done. That's what I would do. I would raise a little bit of a stink and awareness that this is something that can't wait 3 to 6 months, because guess what? You might not be around 3 to 6 months from now if you don't take action now. So that's what I would do. And if you have any questions or follow-up, we are on Facebook, 1480 KPHX. We have a Facebook page. You can always contact me via our Facebook page. And if you don't get satisfactory answers or results, then just contact me through there. We'll see if we can help you out a little bit, okay?
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks a lot, August. Okay. Well, it's kind of sad, Eric. That's, you know, something that we see, you know, throughout, you know, not only the country. We saw it here in our own state. I mean, Eric and I were, you know, very taken aback when we saw what happened here with respect to people on a waiting list for organ transplants. We have there was about 100 patients here in Arizona under the state Medicaid program who had terminal diagnoses. They said, in essence, what happened was if they say their heart wasn't working and they had a cardiomyopathy and they needed a heart transplant, otherwise they're going to die in a certain period of time, and they might have had a leukemia or something along those lines and needed to get treatment for that, otherwise they're going to die. We had our state legislators, Republican conservative legislators here in Arizona, along with a Republican governor, say to those people, sorry, even though you've been approved, we don't have any money, it's going to cost us too much, and you're on your own. And it was an outrage here in Arizona. We created community groups. The community rose up against it. We used the radio as obviously a forum to let other people know what was happening. And fortunately, we got things overturned, but it took months and months and months of time. And eventually, multiple people died because they had no access to health care. And so this, and they had previously had access. The Republicans took it away. So you want to talk about death panels. We had real death panels here in Arizona. Okay, Sarah Palin was right. There are death panels in American medicine, but it's done by conservative Republicans here in the state of Arizona.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back, my friends. Let's get right to the Freedom Lines here. Let's go first in the queue from Doug, who's listening on Sirius XM Satellite Radio in Washington, Iowa. Doug, welcome to the table.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I wanted to talk about the gun control issues and particularly the Republican efforts to initially block debate, and, of course, they're going to do everything they can to amend and confuse people and just delay. Republicans have been just masters at bumper sticker kinds of labels on liberals. So I'm proposing a bumper sticker label back on them. Anybody opposed to background checks, thorough background checks, in my mind is pro-criminal.
Sure.
Or at least pro-gun criminal.
Right, right. No, that's an excellent point there, because that's what you're doing, right? You're aiding and abetting and coddling somebody who really shouldn't have access to the right and the privilege of owning a gun.
That's right.
So I like it. All right, well, let's see if it takes root, Doug. You just introduced it on National Talk Radio, so if you start seeing more pro-criminal, you know, bumper stickers and things coming out there, you know how it happened.
Yep, more completely it's Republicans opposed to common sense gun control are pro-criminal.
Gotcha. All right, appreciate it, Doug. Thanks for holding on, too.
Uh-huh. Thanks, bye.
All right, bye-bye. Okay, there you have it. All right, that's amazing. Some people, he was holding for over an hour there. God bless him. I mean, it's never ceases to amaze me how loyal and dedicated Tom's fans
are. They
got
to say what they got to say.
They got to get in there. All right, 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Let's go next to Renee. Renee is actually from Judah, Wisconsin, listening on Free Speech TV. Renee, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Well, I wanted to call in, and it seems like forever ago that we were talking about the palliative care versus non-valid palliative care. I think that we should at least give people an option. It shouldn't be one way or the other. If you have a disease like Lou Gehrig's, you know, death is going to be this slow walk. And if you would prefer to leave this earth prior to becoming so debilitated that you cannot no longer communicate, I think we should allow people to make that option for themselves.
Sure. And you know what? It's happening. I mean, like we talked about earlier in Washington, that is the law of that particular state. In Oregon, they have a law as well in the books that allows people to, you know, participate in that type of exit, if you will. So it's just a matter of whether or not more states are going to take up that mantle and try to get it either through the state legislators or at least through a referendum by the people on a ballot. But it's taking root. So what do you predict, Renee? Do you think that more states will adopt what we see in Oregon and Washington, or do you not see that happening?
Well, you know, as it is, we're tightening up legislation on whether or not a person can or cannot have a constitutionally granted abortion. So death in any way, shape, or form is, I think these are going to be battled way longer than anything else because, you know, pro-life is pro-life all the way, you know, that's going to be the crux of their argument. Well,
sure. You know, yeah, no, it'll be interesting.
That's how I see it.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for your perspective, Renee. Appreciate the call. Okay, absolutely. Okay, let's go next. Let's see here. Let's go to Omar. He's listening on WCPT in Aurora, Illinois, and wants to talk about women who are happy to have an abortion. Eric, remember that conversation yesterday?
Yes, we got scolded for that.
Yes, we
because
did.
Neither you nor I have had abortions.
Had an abortion. How can we say? All right, well, listen, let's see what Omar's perspective is. Omar, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Hello?
Yes.
Good. I believe I'm for abortions because I think that women would most women that have abortions in my eyes they rationalize it. Like I think that letter that she emailed you,
uh-huh.
Just rationalized the decision, you know, because her kids, she had other kids, and that's just another mouth to feed.
Yeah, she said another mouth to feed, clothe, and educate. So, but I don't know. I had lots of brothers and sisters. We were kind of happy with each other. We weren't very wealthy by any means.
It's like having your own baseball team.
Yeah, it's kind of fun to have brothers and sisters around. So I don't know what she was talking about with respect to that. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, you're right about, you know, having brothers and sisters. But back probably when you was growing up, life was much easier. There was less craziness as there is nowadays.
No, there's a lot more craziness, and I know sometimes women feel as though they need to make that decision based off of an economic, you know, reason, and that's what she was saying with clothes and feeding and education. It's money that she didn't have. But and I respect her decision to do, you know, to exercise her constitutional right to terminate her pregnancy. What I didn't appreciate with her was that she was happy to have the abortion, and that to me is disturbing. I mean, if she was very happy and elated that she had an abortion and now that she doesn't have to feed anybody or clothe anybody or educate anybody and she's celebrating that seems a little sick to me. But listen, Omar, I appreciate the call. Thank you for calling in on the Tom Hartman program. 1-866-987-THOM is that number for the Freedom Lines. 1-866-987-8466. Okay, let's keep going on, Eric. Still got a lot of people we got to get to here before we conclude today's program. So let me see. Next in the queue, it looks like I'm going to go to Sharon. She's calling from Miami, Florida, listening on Sirius XM Satellite. Sharon, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much. I just wanted to take exception to the caller before about the ADHD and nutrition. Obviously, nutrition is very important in every aspect of life. But I think a lot of the reason is diagnostic, just like dyslexia. Years ago, people just weren't diagnosed. I mean, my son is ADHD and attentive type, and from the time he was a baby, he showed symptoms, even when he was breastfeeding and eating everything perfect. So I don't know that there's any controlled study showing that correlation. The other thing, there is a lot of bad medical care out there for ADHD. That I agree with. And it took me 2-3 doctors before I was comfortable with the medication, because I really was very much against it, but he needed it. And, you know, once I found somebody who would titrate very small amounts and was very conservative, it had to be done. But I feel like parents of ADHD children just don't need extra guilt. I don't know that there are any studies again. So.
Oh, no. Yeah, I wouldn't take it that way, Sharon. My impression from her wasn't that she was blaming anybody or saying that, you know, it's solely the food is responsible. I mean, just from me being a physician, what I took away from her comments was that, you know, you have to look at the human body as a whole and that there's lots of things that we call nature nurture, you know, where you said you saw this early on in your child, and that's probably, you know, more of the nature part of it, and that oftentimes when you have a diet or certain things, there could be an interplay between the genetics and also the nutrition that you take. But I don't think she was trying to say that that's the only reason. If she was, I don't agree with that, because, you know, I have family members who've been diagnosed with ADHD, and I've seen the medications that you're talking about, and oftentimes, you know, some medications don't work. Some individuals react differently to one type of amphetamine versus another. And like you said, I'm more of a slow, take it slowly, go slowly, titrate it up, et cetera. But, you know, some people do see some substantial change in the behaviors of their children once they do go on medication. Some people don't see change, and some people react better to cognitive therapy or behavioral therapy. So it really depends on the individual, but it's a real diagnosis, and there are people, like you said, Sharon, like yourself, where your child is under the care of a physician and receiving treatment. What have you seen, though? Have you seen a substantial improvement now that the medicines are titrated?
Oh, incredible. Yeah, he couldn't focus on school before. I mean, he just couldn't. His mind was elsewhere, and we would talk about it, but when he takes the meds and he doesn't, you know, now he's older, he doesn't take them on the weekends if he doesn't want to.
Right.
But for school, he absolutely needs it. And, it's just a huge difference. And, he wasn't learning to read. I mean, his IQ is gifted, but he couldn't learn to read. He's dyslexic, which often goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
And, it had to be done. And so, you know, I kind of like thank God that they're out
there
now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, see, I'm very happy that you got a successful result. And, you know, we just got to be careful because, like you said, ADHD is a real diagnosis. It's a real illness. I've witnessed it, like I said, within my own family. And we just have to be careful because, like you said, there are increasing numbers. And the question is this a result of better diagnostic abilities to identify it earlier, and therefore it's always been around, we're just diagnosing it better now? Or you got to be careful on the other side too, because as you know, the pharmaceutical industry is a huge, big industry with lots of lobbying and lots of money, and we also want to make sure that the pharmaceutical industry isn't the one driving this in an effort to sell just more and more drugs. You follow what I'm saying? There's got to be like a happy medium somewhere in between.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so
that's why I said I went to two doctors who really weren't following his growth well, and that's key. I mean, if your child is on these drugs, you've got to be weighing them constantly and making
absolutely.
Sure. So yeah.
Yeah, you got to look at that Denver developmental graph and see where they are in the, you know, what percentiles and whatnot. All right, well, listen, Sharon, thank you for sharing your personal story with your child. We appreciate that. Bye bye.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
All right. That's Sharon calling in from Miami, Florida. So listen, the Freedom Express is pulling up to its final stop, its final destination for today. If you want to get your final thoughts in here on the Tom Hartman Show, that's Tom Hartman Program. It's the program, Eric. I told you. All right. You can give us a shout out at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, Dr. Mike Newcomb filling in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back, my friends. This is the final segment for the day, final segment for the week. And what a ride it has been, the Freedom Express pulling up to its final stop, final destination for today. But before I get to your calls here to conclude today's program, I also want to take a special time out, Eric, both you and I, to really thank the Tom Hartman Program crew.
Absolutely.
I mean, an incredible crew, everything from Jim Javinsky working with us on
a well-oiled machine
on the Free Speech TV, and also you have Shane making sure this is the best quality broadcast that is possible in talk radio. He does a phenomenal, phenomenal job in making sure those technical aspects of the program are just working flawlessly. And also, Sean, you can not forget Sean Taylor, the executive producer of the program. She does a phenomenal, phenomenal job, classy, just wonderful, wonderful top of the line executive producer. So I really enjoy working with Sean. And, of course, Tom. I mean, Tom, none of us would be here. Last but not least, Tom, we would not be here without him. Tom is an incredible spirit, an incredible soul, somebody whose heart is truly in the right place. As we talked about, you know, last week he was out there in Germany and working with that Salem International organization to help disaffected youth and people throughout the world, and just phenomenal work that he does on that front. He's in Vegas, I believe, this week, doing a keynote speech at a very instrumental conference. And so Tom keeps spreading his wings everywhere he goes, touching people's hearts, their souls, their lives. He's a prolific author, Eric. I mean, he just...
I know. I go in the other room and here at the station, yeah, there's like a stack of Tom Hartman books. I'm like, when does he find time to write
all
that?
We have like a Tom Hartman library here. You walk by, it's right there in the window. So, you know, so kudos to Tom for all he does. He has great passion, and I truly, truly respect him and appreciate the opportunity to really speak to a national audience. So that being said, and also our station too, Eric, we give a little shout out to 1480 KPHX because we've been here for quite some time. We are a liberal oasis in a state that is very, very far right, very, very conservative. And
there's a bunch of stations in town here that are like, you know, wolves in sheep clothing. They say they're progressive, but they're not.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is, you know, a special thanks to the ownership of KPHX, with whom I have a very strong relationship, and we thank them for also the opportunity to do a local show here in town. And Tom also is part of our local lineup as well. So thanks to everyone for the opportunity. And if the listeners want to, you know, find us, you know, because we don't know when we'll be substituting again for Tom in the future, but we do have a Facebook page, I believe, Eric?
1480 KPHX official.
Official.
If you're on Facebook, look for 1480 KPHX and the word official, and you will find the official one because there's other ones masquerading.
Okay, and then you hit the like button, and you can access everything.
You can listen live to the station from there, all that good stuff.
There you go. All right, well, listen, let's get back to the Freedom Lines, Eric. We got Dorothy on the line from Redding, California. It sounds like she was happy after an abortion. So let's investigate that.
I was. And you know what? I was listening to you, and I don't think because you're a man that you totally understand the situation. I was in a terrible marriage, an abusive marriage, and used birth control pills, but I accidentally got pregnant. I was just beside myself. Uh-huh. I felt like I was trapped in a cell with the whole world on top of my shoulders. I went out, and I got an abortion, and I'm going to tell you, I practically floated out of that office after I had the abortion. I was so happy. I felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off of me. I could get out of an abusive marriage. So I understand perfectly what that woman is saying when she said she was happy. I think since you're a man that you've never had the situation where you felt like you were trapped like some women feel like they are trapped, you just probably don't understand it totally. So I just wanted to say that I understood that woman because you didn't.
All right, Dorothy. Well, we appreciate that. But let me ask you one other quick question before I let you go, Dorothy. How much of that elation that you were feeling was not so much from the fact that you just aborted the child but or you know, terminated the pregnancy, but the fact that you were now under that abusive relationship that you were having? Because that seems to be that the two are pretty closely tied to that.
You know what? I didn't feel guilty. I had a long talk with who is now my ex-brother-in-law, who is an MD in Southern California, and we discussed abortion. And he said, now this is your doctor, so this is what he explained to me. Uh-huh. He said that it takes oxygen, like when the baby is born, you know, the lungs have to fill up, they smack them and the lungs fill up. He said it takes the oxygen, if you will, the breath of life to activate everything. And after I had the talk with him and he explained it to me, when it came time and I did decide on that abortion, I did not feel guilty at all. I did not feel like I was killing a human life when I had it. So I was happy.
No. We understand that. I think when we were speaking about it, Eric and I, we were saying that going through the actual procedure, you know, of
that's like going to the dentist.
Yeah.
Well, that's not pleasant.
Well, that's what we were saying. I mean, we can't imagine anybody. I mean, you're offering a different perspective. You're saying from an emotional point of view, being in an abusive relationship and not wanting to have gotten pregnant, and unfortunately, you did.
There.
Right. No,
it's trapped. You're like trapped.
Yeah, but men get trapped. Men get trapped as well.
Yeah.
What did you think about my brother-in-law's point on the oxygen?
Well, I wasn't sure what he was meaning because I know what you're talking about, the ability to breathe. Like usually around 36 weeks in a pregnancy, which obviously you weren't that pregnant, but at 36 weeks, the baby, the fetus, whatever you want to call it, has the ability with this chemical called surfactant. It usually becomes active around 36 weeks so that the baby, if it exits the womb at that point, can breathe on its own. But usually prior to that, if you don't have this surfactant chemical, the baby would not be able to breathe on their own and would need support if it there were to exit the womb prematurely.
So he was explaining to me before I had even decided or became pregnant, we discussed it.
All right. Well, Dorothy, listen, we appreciate you calling in and we appreciate your perspective. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. All right. There you have it. Okay. Well, that kind of wraps it up, Eric. To the other people, I apologize. Couldn't get to you, but I'm sure we'll have an opportunity at some point in the future to speak again. So, again, a special thanks to Tom, a special thanks to his crew, and a special thanks to you, the listeners, for participating and making this a wonderful ride over the last 7 days. So God bless, and we'll talk to you soon.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.